Hello, listeners. This is your host, Cody Starkin, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Standing Post. Back on May 2017, the Secret Service, Homeland Security Investigations, and the Miami-Dade Police Department were notified by Target Special Investigators regarding several suspects impersonating Target headquarters employees. These suspects were calling stores around the U.S. to get employees to load money on Target gift cards to purchase and sell items at a later date. Our guest this month walks us through that investigation that took more than a year and a half to complete, which resulted in Operation Benefactor and Deja Vu to bring these fraudsters into custody. On a special note, this is our first call-in guest from the field. The audio will be a little different, but we hope you enjoy the episode. Now, please welcome to the show, Special Agent Logan Workman. Special Agent Logan Workman, thank you for coming on the show today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy day to be able to discuss with us a investigation that you were a part of, and I believe you led, and we wanted to have you on the show to kind of tell that story. But before we do, can you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yes, I'm Special Agent Logan Workman. I'm in the Miami field office here in Florida, and I've been with the Secret Service for 4 years now. I've enjoyed the job very much. I look forward to the rest of this interview.
Well, we're happy to have you on the show. And before we start and to talk about the investigation that you were part of, can you kind of describe how, you know, your home life growing up and how you heard about the Secret Service?
Yeah, so I grew up in Georgia. I was born in Macon. I grew up in a small town called Thomaston, Georgia. I went through school, and then at some point during high school, we moved to Columbia, South Carolina. Once I finished high school there, I joined the United States Air Force, and I was stationed in Hickam Air Force Base, Hawaii. And it's on the island of Oahu. Oh,
that's a nice first assignment.
There, yeah, it was great. It was an amazing time. Probably the best decision I ever made, which set me up for the rest of my career, which is where I learned that I loved being in law enforcement. I kind of went in open general in hopes of being a firefighter, and then they put me into security forces, which is the Air Force's version of military police. Mm-hmm. Then I did a lot of training with Honolulu Police Department. And then we just, you know, we would go to calls on Hickam Air Force Base, which is now, it doesn't exist anymore. Now it's Joint Base Pearl Harbor, because they're connected. Mm-hmm. At the time they were separate, but now they're up against each other. And then that's where I learned I loved to be in law enforcement. I knew I wanted to be a federal agent, but I hadn't finished my college yet. So I separated after 4 years and finished all my schooling, finished my bachelor's degree, and then went and got a graduate degree. While I got some experience, became a deputy for Richland County, South Carolina, which is the Columbia area. I was also a military reservist in the Air Force, security forces as well, out of Fort Bragg.
Okay.
On that 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year, and I was a law enforcement instructor there, and then was a deputy for about 4 years, and I got hired by the Secret Service out of the Columbia field office.
Okay, and was there any particular reason why you wanted to join the Secret Service?
You know, I wanted to join one of the main ones. I applied to the Secret Service, never having a clue that I would actually get the job. Were inviting me to the test, I passed the test. They invited me to do the interview. Crazy nervous. I passed the interview. I passed the polygraph. And then, you know, then I had to do the physical. Everything was just moving. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of mind blowing from coming from a deputy in South Carolina to protecting the president maybe one day. You know, long story short, got the job, super excited, went through, did everything I wanted. I mean, it was a dream come true. So for this, all that mattered to me was that, you know, an agency saw the value I had and hired me, and I'm going to stick with it, and I'm here to the end of my career.
So, Logan, I think this is a good time to transition to the reason why we have you on the show here and to talk about the fraudsters that were, like, literally targeting Target and basically running a scheme to steal money from the company. Can you kind of set the stage for how this investigation came into your office and to you specifically?
Yeah, so I was working a case involving a skimmer that was a local, indicted this guy, and then he came back to me and said, hey, FDLE, which is the state law enforcement agency for Florida, has this case, and some of the suspects are in our area, and they're asking us to look into this bank fraud scheme. And so I got in touch with the FDLE agents and then started working on this bank fraud scheme, which is a separate case that I worked with them. And then they brought to me another lead that came from Target investigators. And from that lead, I got a hold of the Target investigators, and they gave me all the information on this case. They described the scheme. They went into detail. They had identified some of the suspects. There was multiple runners at this point, though. So they just had photographs and license plates, and they're only able to go so far. They're great, but they can do a lot of the legwork. But once they provide that information to me, I can go in some of the databases that they do not have access to and start looking at, you know, what are their addresses? Who are their relatives? I can, based on the license plates, you can get the names through the DMV for the state of Florida. Look at who's on the insurance, and you can start pulling social media pictures, driver's license photos, and try to identify some of these suspects. The scheme itself involved a large amount of people going inside of the Target stores throughout the Southern District of Florida, which when I say Southern District of Florida, I'm talking about from Palm Beach area all the way down to Key West. So, and that's a big chunk of Florida that we cover here in the Miami office.
Okay.
And these individuals would call into the store employees, right? So they would either call to the register or they would call to the electronics section, you know, any random point in the store. They would, a lot of times, would just call the main number, would get transferred to customer service, electronics, or the registers. Now, somebody along the way had inside knowledge on whether they were a former employee or they knew a former employee, to where they knew exactly what keys to hit because they knew their computer system. So it was very convincing.
Okay.
We actually had some of these transcripted calls from a manager. It broke it line by line, a conversation between the employee and the caller. And what they did was social engineering. Now, to talk about what social engineering is, the use of deception to manipulate individuals into divulging confidential or personal information that may be used for fraudulent purposes. So that's the technical definition.
Okay.
And in other words, it's somebody that's calling somebody and convincing them to do what they want them to do, whether it be by elaborate story or impersonating. Simply, it's convincing them by fraudulent means. So in this case, they called the store. They would instruct the employee to select gift cards next to the register. They would tell them that they worked for the store and that they were from their corporate headquarters. They would then say, we need to test these gift cards you're selecting in your store to make sure your gift card system is working.
Mm-hmm.
So once they select the gift card, they would have them scan the gift cards, and then they would manually input the numbers on the computer. So and essentially, they would guide them from page to page, which keys to hit, whether it be F1, F4, how do you get this, you know, it would lead them to the specific screen to load the card. So, you know, as an employee, you know, it's very believable because they're telling them what keys to hit. You know,
right.
It's very, so why, how would somebody know this if they're not an employee? In this case, they were not an employee. They would load the cards with dollar amounts and increments of $500 to $2,000 at a time. They would do this over and over again, a lot of times in the same phone call. Some of the employees would load $10,000 to $15,000 per phone call. The employee would then read that number to the caller over the phone, and then within an hour, sometimes 30 minutes, these individuals that were doing this crime were here in the Southern District of Florida. Sometimes they would run into the store because the Target fraud team wasn't aware of this, and they were shutting the cards down.
Okay.
So they would run into the store and try to use the gift card at self-checkout through their mobile phone. So once you get on the app, you can type in the gift card number and it'll populate a barcode.
Okay.
So that gift card's valid. You can buy other gift cards with this, and it would layer, it would separate you from the, you know, the fraudulently obtained gift card. And now you have essentially these clean gift cards that you can walk around and use without worry about them getting shut down, or you can give them away, you know. So they knew they're on the clock a lot of these times, because the, at first they were getting away with it. They could just use the phone. And at some point they were using the gift cards to buy other gift cards, which, and then they would buy high-end electronics, which then they would sell somewhere else.
So basically, when the window was closing further and further to be able to utilize the cards, they were finding different methods to kind of transfer the money or to buy items to fence?
Yeah. So initially, this went on for about 7 months. And that's how, you know, it got to a certain point. Once it got over $1 million, Target said, oh, wow, we're losing a lot of money on this. And that's when they started to put it together. And they had their teams monitoring how these gift cards are loaded, so they can tell, you know, when a gift card is loaded through the register by the means that it was, you know, manually inputting the dollar amounts on the cards. They would, those would flag once they get over a certain dollar amount. They would always flag, like, increment they set it at. So, for example, if they set it at $500, they would get a notification that a gift card was loaded in Oregon at this store number for, by at the register manually for $1,000. And then that's how we would know. And then we're following the gift card. And then here in the Southern District of Florida, we have these individuals running in and using these gift cards to buy electronics.
I guess with the timeline and how this flowed, basically Target talked to Florida Department of Law Enforcement, which came to you. And I'm going to take a little step back here. When that happens, like, what would trigger? Is it just, is FDLE saying, the Secret Service has these investigation methods that we don't have access to, so, you know, we're just going to reach out through the partnerships you guys built, and they pretty much work with them to help them with the case to kind of solve it? Or do they just hand it over to you and say, hey, you know, do you mind taking a look at this? Or is it more of a joint effort?
It's a joint effort. They either, in times, they need assistance, or they want to make it a federal case.
Okay.
Because maybe they haven't had, in certain areas, a lot of luck in prosecuting some of these state cases, and they feel like the penalties on the federal side are a little stiffer than they would get on the state side.
Okay.
But, you know, and that's the importance of developing these relationships, because these are good cases. And once you develop these partnerships with, whether it be private sector, bank investigators, retail investigators, or local and state law enforcement, they get these big cases, they'll bring them to you, and you can work them together, and you can do these things over and over again, as long as you maintain these relationships with your local, state, and private partners.
You know, thank you for sharing that as far as, you know, just the kind of the intricacies of the investigation. One thing I did want to highlight on, though, too, is even while you're doing this, you still have other responsibilities you have to attend to. At any given time, a protection assignment can come up where you kind of have to table the investigations that day and go work protection. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And pretty much that's kind of like how fluid the investigation process can be, is where you're working so many days and then you can be pulled from it to do other obligations within the field office, I'm assuming.
That's correct. When, in a lot, in almost all cases, and I don't, it's not necessarily Miami, I know it's in many other field offices, when you're working these cases, it's just a nature of being a Secret Service agent, is that you could get pulled away almost at any time to do protection, whether it be to travel or your in-district protection. And especially in Miami, when you have Mar-a-Lago going on, you know, some of these, if you get put on one of those advances, then with the advance time and they stay there for an extended period of time, you could be out of the game for 2 to 3 weeks at a time.
So as you're moving through day-to-day, doing the protection, working the investigation, at what point did you find a tipping point where you said, okay, we can move in and take these individuals? I mean, can you kind of move on to the next steps as far as where the investigation led you and kind of where, I guess, the culmination point occurred?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time. I put myself on the, we have a 24/7 duty desk, we call it in here. So you work in 8-hour shifts. While I was on there, you can really do, you're basically answering calls as they come in.
Okay.
Or our region in the Secret Service. So 9 to 5, you're going to get Miami or Southern District of Florida calls. The local field offices in the respected areas in this southeast region of the United States will get their calls from during office hours. But after office hours, they are automatically, the phones are rolled to the Miami office because we're 24/7. So when you're on the duty desk, you answer these calls from police officers, whether it's a protective intelligence issue, and you can look up who's on call and send them out. Say it's in Tennessee and it's after hours, you can pull up the Tennessee roster and see who's there and send that agent out.
Okay.
So while you're there, you have a lot of time also to do administrative work. So while I put myself on the duty desk, I was able to crunch together a lot of the data through Target and communicate with them through their video and their still shot. And sometimes, and looking at the invoices, sometimes they would order some of this merchandise through these gift cards that were fraudulently obtained and order items to be picked up in the store. And sometimes they would put their real names on them.
Mm.
And that's how we figured out who they are. Because when you're just looking at video, all you see is a picture, sometimes not so great. And then they're not using credit cards. So there's no names attached to these gift cards. And then they leave the store and they get in these vehicles. And then you might get lucky and get a license plate, but you've got to start digging from there. So your database checks and social media checks to see if you can figure out who these people are. And in this case, they're not always, you know, most expert criminals in the world,
right?
They would put their names on the pickup orders. So they would use the card for pickup. They would have a different name when they place the order online, target.com, for the purchaser. And then they would change the name to a different name, which you can do that as long as you change it online. Somebody else can pick it up for you. So they would put, so if they're working in groups, which they were, one or the caller may order the merchandise online and send his friend to go pick it up in the store. And then they would come out. They're just trying, and they wouldn't do it consistently. They would take turns essentially. So it spreads it out a little bit amongst all of them. So they're not constantly seen in the store buying this fraudulently obtained or picking up this fraudulently obtained merchandise. So we developed some chart. We identified a handful of people. We did some surveillance once I got off the duty desk, and actually with some luck, went to the store and they were still in the store. We got one of these alerts from the fraud department and we drove over there and they were taking their time and they were in the store. And so I went into the loss prevention office and we're following them around on the camera. And then I just walked out behind them and then we just surveilled them from there to a house and then watched them meet up with another guy who we identified through his vehicle in the apartment they went into. And then as luck would have it again, within that week, they ordered some electronics to that very same apartment. So we got with the UPS driver and a UPS fraud investigator. They have their own investigators that work for UPS. We had him pick up the package, put it in a empty UPS truck and put a uniform on. And we put a button camera in his shirt. And then we delivered the package, and we had another suspect now receiving the package. His signature, it was under an assumed name. It wasn't under his real name. It was under an alias that he used on his social media. Searching that alias on social media, we were able to find out who this other guy really was. At the end of it, we actually, through interviews, and we identified him as being one of the callers, actually. So the way I explained it earlier is that someone would place their order online, then they would change the name for pickup. And so we can call these guys, this group of people, runners.
Okay.
So you have a few like masterminds, I would say, we can call them in the scheme, who meet these acquaintances or their friends of theirs, and then they send them with the gift cards, bring them back the electronics, which they are in turn paid for these electronics. And then the caller ends up selling them by some other means. So that was one of the methods we used to identify some of the suspects was the delivery and the surveillance, and then of course through all of the pickup names, and they'll use their actual names for the pickups.
Okay.
So some people would think, oh well, maybe this isn't enough to indict them because they could be doing this innocently just for a side job working for one of these guys. If they only did it once or twice, these are not some of the people that we indicted, because that is a valid argument. However, when the ones we were able, because there was many, many runners, but the ones we did indict, they showed a pattern of fraud. So over an extended period of time, 5-12 months, we were able to put together what we call a cell phone link chart, or a telephone link chart, to where it would show on this graph, these charts by the individual we identified, the call place. It would give a time, date, and location, whether that call be to California. And then it shows a line would go to the cell phone, then a line would go to where it was redeemed in South Florida.
Okay.
So it would show a pattern that the card was loaded within an hour at this time, and then it was redeemed within an hour in Southern District of Florida. So there's no other way to have that gift card unless you were in some form a part of that originating phone call.
Okay.
So we showed this over and over and over again over an extended period of time. And then a lot of times they would do these under fake Cartwheel accounts. So they would create these, you know, spoofed Cartwheel accounts, which a Cartwheel account is like this account you use, basically their app, right?
Okay.
So they can log in and create an account. And then they would use only this fraud. They would only do fraud on these accounts with these fraudulently obtained gift cards to buy electronics, the same electronics over and over and over and over again, whether it be gaming systems, Apple devices, cell phones. So we have this pattern that with these charts and then showing the connection, we also used IP addresses
mm-hmm.
to where they were logging on and placing these orders to be delivered to stores. We're able to retrieve that IP address information, and we were showing a nice spider web of connection between the overall conspiracy between these people.
And that's what I was going to ask, is at what point did you decide, okay, we can move on these individuals?
So once we put together two separate indictments, actually in the first wave, there was three separate indictments.
Okay.
We identified some other players later. So the first round of indictments we put together, we indicted 7. And then the second indictment, we did 5. And then the third indictment, we did 2. So once we got the indictment, once you go testify before the grand jury, the U.S. Attorney's Office will issue arrest warrants. At that point, and during the investigation, you want to figure out where these people live so you can go arrest them. You want to arrest them. In a lot of cases, what we do, we try to do an operation to where we arrest most of the suspects, as many as we can locate at one time. So we call these bed downs, to where we put eyes on where someone lives, and then we set up a plan based on whether it's the criminal history. Are these guys violent? Are they felons? Are they on probation? In some cases, some of these guys were on probation. And we were able to bring in the state probation office to assist us. Some of them had ankle monitors where we could see if they were coming and going. And you were able to schedule your raid and get your manpower based upon all these factors, right? So we've identified where 10 of these people live, and we don't know where the other two are, but we're working on it. So we will set up teams for 10 separate houses, which each team requires a certain amount of bodies as well, because if you've seen them in the residence and they don't come to the door, you've got to move on based on the team leader. You can decide if you're going to make entry, if you're not, are they destroying evidence? You know, this was an ongoing case up until the day before we went and arrested everybody. We're actually following, not to get off track, but we actually were following, just to show how active this was, we're actually following four of them that were working together in doing this scheme. But in our plan the night before they raids, actually, was to arrest them in their car because they were all together while they were doing it.
Oh, okay.
In the meantime, at the same time, we're getting communication, and Target keeps saying, oh, they're over here, they're at this store, they're all together at this store at 9, 10 at night doing it right now, right before they close. So when we were prepping for that the night before, they actually, a few nights before, we were going to arrest them, but you couldn't keep, they drove like, you know, maniacs. So mm-hmm. we actually had to go apply for, and we couldn't find a good location on where this car was parked. So then some of these guys were staying together, and we eventually located the car and then installed a tracker on the car. And this was a couple of nights before the raids. And that way, that morning, we actually knew which apartment some of these guys were staying in.
I was fortunate enough to be able to witness the events that unfolded that morning. So after the, you know, seeking the indictments and you having to move with the move to arrest these individuals, this raid that was taking place all over South Florida, can you kind of describe and just what you can to the listeners about that morning and what you had to go through as an agent?
So the day before, we did a large briefing at the Secret Service Miami field office, which included most of the personnel that were going to be involved for the next morning. So we did in the conference room here, we had a PowerPoint presentation to go over each team, each person that was going to be arrested with their criminal histories. I handed out folders to each team leader. And these teams were broken up between the ATF, the U.S. Marshals, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and the Secret Service. So we've determined that a central location where almost all of the people involved in this case were located was in the city of Miami Gardens, Florida. So we got with Miami Gardens Police Department, and they were going to let us base our operation out of their police department. And then the morning of, we all gathered at the Miami Gardens Police Department. And there was approximately 100 law enforcement there, sworn law enforcement, to include uniformed officers and all the federal agents and state agents and task force officers and detectives that were helping us. I briefed up the teams. Everybody broke up in their individual teams from there, and then they set out to where they were going to execute their warrants. We also had a Homeland Security Investigations tactical team going to one of the residences due to a large amount of drug activity going on in that house and lots of firearms. The people living there, along with our indicted individual, were drug dealers. And so we sent a tactical team for that one. We used the marshals to hit other various sites. They sent a few teams. They did the entries, and then some of the sites, the Secret Service did the entries. So once everybody separated from there at 6 a.m., this was at 5:30 in the morning, and then at 6 a.m., everybody, all 11 sites executed their warrants simultaneously, and the majority of them were taken into custody. They were all brought back to the Miami Gardens Police Department, where I spent the day interviewing each of them, got confessions from a large amount of them, and that also led us to who actually were making the calls amongst that group to the stores, and then disseminating those gift cards out to their runners.
It's probably common sense in the law enforcement community, but coming from an outside perspective, when you get intelligence or information about these individuals, do you bring in the other law enforcement agencies to be able to handle that?
Yeah. So as a Secret Service, we just don't have the manpower to do these types of operations. It required, like I said, this was 100 state, local, and federal law enforcement involved. We only have 90 Secret Service here in the Miami field office. So not everybody can drop what they're doing to come help me on my case. They have their own cases. They have protection assignments. We did get a majority of the Secret Service Miami field office, but we have task force officers that are sworn and deputized to help with federal cases. So they work for the Secret Service. So we use them. They belong to local or state jurisdictions. This was all occurring in Miami Gardens. So we take a Miami Gardens marked unit to go to each site. And we typically do that because they can turn the lights on, and then it gives the people in the house in the surrounding houses to know this is not a burglary. This is a law enforcement action.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, it's manpower supplement, you know, the health supplements us with the manpower to use these other agencies. And it's a benefit to have, you know, for example, like I said, we brought the ATF, but a lot of these guys were felons and a lot of them did have firearms. So if we found a firearm or fell in possession of a firearm, then we would hand those over to the ATF, who are the experts in that. And the marshals, we use them as entry teams because they're trained on a normal basis, they're fugitive teams, to execute these warrants. And when you work as a team, it helps everybody out, not alone with just manpower, but with expertise.
So going past the raids, was there like anything else you wanted to talk about beyond that? Like what occurred after you brought them in, you started talking to them, you're getting all this information from them. Did that lead to other suspects or other people that you were able to identify?
Yeah, so we weren't able to find one of the ones that were indicted. But okay. Through interviews, we targeted him. We found they confessed that he was actually the one leading this other group.
Okay.
One of the groups of the group of indictments that we did. So we had lots of leads on where he was. But we didn't know exactly. However, we were able to obtain his active cell phone number from one of the ones we arrested's cell phone. He was communicating with him. He did not know they had all been arrested. But at some point, he did find out. So he was, you know, on the run. We were able to show that we've exhausted all means trying to locate him. But we do have his cell phone number. So we actually obtained a cell phone tracking warrant, and this requires two warrants. It requires a search warrant for the carrier, whether it be Verizon, AT&T, or whatever the cell phone carrier is, and you issue the search warrant to the carrier, and we track him to a hotel. And as we're in the parking lot, he's walking across the street to the gas station, and we took him in the parking lot. So, you know, we tracked this other guy, one of the last guys in this wave, through the cell phone tracking warrant. And then he, not that day, but later, he did confess to him making the phone calls, which was a win because we always wanted to find the source of these phone calls. Because if we were just to get the runners, then it could keep going on.
Logan, so that kind of wrapped up, I think, the first raid and the individuals you were able to get that morning. It kind of led to a subsequent raid a little later because you had mentioned that there was another one in January 2019.
Yes, so we already had a playbook on how to do these cases at this point, and Target came back to the Secret Service, to the Miami field office, with another large group of these individuals doing the same scheme. So going off the playbook from before, we just put together, they knew exactly what we needed with the video, with the stills, with the receipts, with the link chart. Target put together these elaborate charts, which were amazing. They linked everybody through social media, through gift cards shared, right? So,
mm-hmm.
Individual one and individual two are in separate locations. However, they're using the same gift card. So they either know each other, or they are getting the gift card from the same source. So we're able to develop a large conspiracy based on that, and also IP addresses and from online orders and emails associated to the orders that were picked up, whether they were from the same IP address or not. They picked up a different set of electronics through the same email place with the order. Mm-hmm. So it gets very... It's very data heavy.
Okay.
But we were able to put together another large group. We mirrored the raid from the first round, and mm-hmm. we went out and arrested 14 at one time, and the same day. So,
it's amazing.
And this one was in partnership with Homeland Security Investigations. We headquartered it out of their office. Just because they had multiple holding cells in their office. They had all of the interview rooms as well. And here at the Secret Service office, we don't have the holding cells. So we arrested everybody. I interviewed them throughout the day. We got a lot of confessions. And we had some more leads that actually led us to do 3 search warrants. Then very next morning, you know, that evening I went to the judge's house at, you know, 10 at night and had a few search warrants signed. And then very next morning, we executed 2 search warrants on 2 residences that were identified as a fence for these electronics. When I say a fence, I mean, this was a delivery area where they would obtain these electronics through these fraudulently obtained gift cards. They would go deliver it to these residences, offload the electronics into the garage and receive payment. And then they would do this over and over and over again. So we had some of the individuals that gave us the leads that were arrested drive us to these residences and show us exactly where they were delivering these electronics. So from the search warrants, we gathered more intel. We retrieved lots of electronics from the residences, and then they drove us with another lead to a warehouse where they were selling their electronics obtained from these other people.
Oh, man. Okay.
So it was another area separated from the original fence. So we went to that warehouse. He showed us. I went and obtained another search warrant for the storage unit or warehouse where it was. We went and cut the locks, and then we opened the door, and there is just a mountain of PlayStations, laptops, Xboxes, Apple AirPods,
and is
Google.
Well, I was going to ask, is this something that, is common? I mean, it's probably a dumb question, but, oftentimes when you're doing these investigations, is it common just to keep going like this as far as finding new leads as it continues to connect to other sources?
It's not as common. I mean, it's common. Usually you can already know these things ahead of time. But in this case, it was developing, and it was just, you didn't want the trail to go cold, because if you waited too long, then they'll get wind that their partners were arrested, and they'll dispose of these electronics. We're not going to find the electronics, you know?
Okay.
So whether they're resold or they're shipped overseas to different countries, or they just segregate themselves from the property, which in this case, the owner of that storage unit had not yet. So we served a subpoena on the storage facility, and then we indicted the renter of that storage facility, who was also identified by the other individuals that told us about it, that they would sell to him specifically, and then we arrested him. And he ended up being one of the top guys in this entire scheme, and they were selling it overseas to foreign countries. So, yeah, and then once everybody was arrested, everybody since has been convicted in the case. There was not one trial. Everybody pled guilty out of both waves. And we actually, one of the main guys, and you can see on the chart how the spider web, how he's connected. He's the center point of sort of this. Look at a conspiracy sometimes as a bicycle wheel, with the main conspirator being the center wheel with the spokes going out. He was actually committing the same scheme while on bond. So he drove his car. The store got the license plate. He had an ankle monitor on. It matched up with the times of the scheme, exiting and arriving in the apartment. And then we used that against him in sentencing, and he actually got an extra 2 years on top of what he was going to get.
So when it was all said and done, I mean, how much did this ring steal from Target?
It was approximately $4 million.
You know, it amazes me that this is just like an investigation that you were able to see through to the end there. And I appreciate being able to have you share that story with the listeners. Every day I work here, there tends to be new stories that pop up about these elaborate schemes and how the Secret Service is able to take them down. So I just want to say thank you for sharing that story with us.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Yeah, I love my job here. And fraud comes in many forms, whether it's bank fraud, mortgage fraud, access device fraud, wire fraud, mail fraud. I mean, it goes on, and the you can almost find some sort of nexus to fraud in almost any case, because usually it's all about the money, and it's just whether it's, we work money laundering as well. So, you know, whether it's drugs, there's a money laundering angle. Whether it's weapons, there's a money laundering angle. There's probably a wire fraud angle, especially in the Miami district. Like I said earlier, that you can just literally bounce from one case to the next. There's no shortages of cases of fraud in the Miami area.
Logan, do you have anything for the listeners you'd like to share or anything you'd like to tell them?
If you love to stay busy, the Secret Service is for you. You can jump from one case to the next, one assignment to the next, and the opportunities for just changing your career, whether one year to the next, whether it's you want to do a different task within the service or a job, or you want to work a certain type of cases, or you want to do more protection and be more versed in that area. There's just lots of opportunity, and it's just love being in the Secret Service day in and out.
Well, Special Agent Workman, I appreciate your time and coming on the show and talking to us, to me, to the listeners, and hopefully we'll have you on another time down the road whenever you feel like coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you again for listening to another episode of Standing Post. For more information about the Secret Service or how to join, please go to www.secretservice.gov. Until next month, listeners, stay vigilant.